At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show I talk to Hangover star Ken Jeong and the rest of the voice cast of the new Netflix movie Over the Moon. The director of Bird Box and The Night Manager on her scintillating new TV show The Undoing. Mark Ryle on this week's new releases and philosopher Richard Carney on his favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're surviving lockdown number two so far. Be kind to yourselves. Light fires, drink wine. Don't worry about learning Japanese and baking sourdough. Just get through it. And you will get through it, my friends. And as I say, good weekend to you all. Now, the big movie release, news story of the week is probably the new Borat movie and Mayor Giuliani and all that stuff you've been reading about. I never got a link. I never got a screener. So I actually haven't seen it. I don't know. I slipped through the cracks on this one. So, you know, I pride myself on never lying to you about having watched things that I haven't seen. I think that's important. And I haven't. So I haven't seen it, but maybe more of that next week. I'm a big fan of his, Sacha Baron Cohen. It's always interesting. It's never dull, and it certainly isn't dull this week. So maybe more of that anon. Now, I really have very little time this week because we have a packed show. Sorry, it's terrible, you know. It's like someone coming to a party saying, I can't stay long, you know, but I just have a lot of great stuff to bring you. But I just want to mention one correspondence I had during the week, and thank you for anyone who got in touch via email, screentime@newstalk.com, or on Twitter, John_Fardy. I got an email from County Antrim, where Newstalk doesn't technically broadcast, but Martin, who walks on his beach near where he lives, presumably in Antrim, maybe along the gorgeous Antrim coast there, listens to the podcast most Saturday mornings when he's out walking and was just saying how much he enjoyed the show. So thank you very much, Martin. But also about Girl/Haji, which was based in Tokyo and London. It was on the BBC but moved to Netflix. He thinks it's brilliant, and I've heard it's brilliant, and I've yet to do it, Martin, but I will, and I may well report back to you. And thank you for getting in touch. Now, in TV, I was watching this.
You know what I love about this? You could never tell they were rich. It's all so classy and understated.
I'll make it up to you later.
Make it up to me now. Let's find a room. They must have a few.
You're so bad.
This is what rich, entitled people do when threatened. They conceal the ugly truths to protect themselves.
The community is in shock tonight over the gruesome discovery of a fourth-grade mother found bludgeoned to death.
Now, that's a clip from The Undoing, which will be on Sky Atlantic from Monday night, the 26th of October, and also streaming on Now TV. Now, The Undoing is, as you heard there, it stars Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant, and it's classic white picket fence America, even though it's set in New York. Nicole Kidman is this upwardly mobile psychotherapist. She's one child with her seemingly adoring husband, Hugh Grant, who's a doctor. Hugh Grant's great in it, by the way. He's not, there's a touch of the bumbling Englishman, but there's a lot more to it besides. There is a murder. Hugh Grant goes missing. It's all very strange. There's a real touch of Big Little Lies and Little Fires Everywhere about it. It's really good. I've watched the first three episodes and I was hooked. Now, it's directed by a lady called Suzanne Beer, who did The Night Manager. We needn't say much more. She also did Bird Box on Netflix. She made a movie. She's Danish. She made a movie called Brothers years ago that Jim Sheridan redid and made a kind of American version of it. She's been in the game a long time directing movies and indeed TV. And I had a chat with her this week. this hopefully comes as a compliment to you. Me and my wife are parents to three small children, so our viewing time is limited, and we both had to go to bed a couple of nights ago, and my wife was saying, just one more, just one more, and we stayed up far too late. She was talking about your wonderful TV show, incidentally. And is that, did you get the script and go, this is just edge of the seat stuff? Because I found it that way. Were you dying to make it when you read it?
Well, I got involved when David Kelly had written the very first draft of the first episode. And he'd written Grace. He knew that Nicole Kidman was going to play Grace. But it was incredibly compelling. But it was also something which could go either more thriller or more drama. And I was like, hey, listen, I think we should make this into a thriller. And I think we should do... I'm aiming for it being so tense that throughout six episodes, audience are going to sit at the edge of the seat. So when you say you and your wife stayed up because they wanted to watch you, because you wanted to watch one more, it makes me very happy.
Good.
Very happy. I regret your lack of sleep, but on a very selfish level,
it's fine. That's not your fault. Hugh Grant is a wonderful actor, and maybe it's a particularly Irish thing, but we kind of see him as like, he's a great talk show guest, and he's wonderful in movies like Four Weddings and a Funeral and Paddington 2, and he has this kind of almost Cary Grant quality about him, that he's a lovable kind of muddling fool at times almost. But this shows, and he has done other things, but this in particular shows just what a wide range he has. Did you always want him in this for those kind of reasons?
Yes. I mean, that was the first thing I told Nicole Kidman and David Kelly, that I thought Hugh Grant should play Jonathan. I've always been intrigued with Hugh Grant as an actor. I've always felt that there was this fun, that very charming side you described to him, the kind of lovable side, but there was also a darkness. And by darkness, I don't mean anything bad. I mean, I always felt that there was a sadness to him, something kind of melancholic or underneath the fun. And I just thought that would be perfect for this story.
Yeah.
And I thought that they would be a perfect couple,
yeah.
Like very believable, very fun, very kind of natural. And fortunately, they are.
Yeah, they certainly are. They sparkle and they sizzle. And of course, you also have Donald Sutherland. It's just, he's one of my favorite actors of all time. He just brightens up everything he's on. Was it hard to get him involved? Because I know he doesn't do that much stuff anymore.
You know, David's writing is so compelling that I think everybody who kind of enjoys the craft and sort of is immediately drawn to anything that David Kelly writes, and Donald Sutherland felt that way. And there's one particular scene, I know this for sure, which where Donald Sutherland went, I have to do this show. A scene where he tells the headmaster off in a very uncompromising way. Mm. And he uses a language you wouldn't expect, but it seems surprisingly natural.
Yeah, he's just wonderful, and he's wonderful in this. You know, I was talking to, his name momentarily escapes me, a very famous movie critic. And it's his contention that the best movie of 2020 is the last four episodes of Ozark, because he found them so compelling. And he said they were as good as anything on the big screen this year so far. And you're someone who's been highly successful in movies, but also on TV. Is that kind of line between, for someone like you, whether it's TV or movies, are they becoming very similar enterprises nowadays, especially when people like Donald Sutherland and Nicole Kidman are in them?
For sure, the lines are being blurred, and for sure, because, you know, The Undoing is essentially a six-hour-long film.
Yeah.
And I've treated it exactly like I would a very, very long film. And it has the arcs, and he has it sort of the end of each episode, which brings you hopefully into the next. But essentially, that's what it is. Yeah. And I did the same thing with The Night Manager. I also treated that as a very, very long film. And I think it's incredibly attractive for a director to have such a long format to work in. Mm. And yes, the lines are definitely blurred.
Yeah. And talking of David Kelly, and not to mention other shows, but I was thinking of Big Little Lies, and I was also reminded of Little Fires Everywhere, and your show, although they're very different in some ways, they do have the theme of, I suppose, going behind middle class and upper class life, particularly from a woman's perspective, that these kind of, what we call them in Ireland, yummy mummies who have perfect lives, and shows like yours and those other ones I've mentioned, there seems to be a theme at the moment to, I don't know, go behind the white picket fences. Is that something you're aware of?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I want to say that even just reading first episode, I was very aware of sort of the potential of describing that world, of describing that world of privilege and you know, being an immaculate mom, taking your kid to school in a limousine, wearing your fitness gear, which is all the right fitness gear, and the sort of slight, the sort of sarcasm, which is the undercurrent of the description of the world, the oblivion of privilege.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I think in this particular case, you know, there's a ticking bomb under the privilege, because it really is about how that world unravels when a tragedy occurs.
Yeah.
But the undercurrent of the sort of, you know, the way the justice systems are favoring the world of privilege, the way that whole thing is a very important part of the show. And even the detective played by Edgar Ramirez, who is sort of quite hostile to Nicole Kidman. Mm. He's not hostile because he dislikes Grace, who's played by Nicole Kidman. He's hostile because he's fed up with what privilege, sort of in the fact that privilege makes it impossible for them not to help and not to aid, and very important murder investigation.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me this, if you don't mind me asking. You're probably aware of one of our greatest living directors is a man called Jim Sheridan, and he made a great movie called Brothers, and I had known it was a remake. And to my shame, I didn't realize that you had made it until about 24 hours ago when I was reading up on you. So I'm going to have to watch your movie, and apologies for not seeing it. Have you seen Jim's kind of take on your movie? And what
did you think of it? I liked it. You know, I thought it was, I really enjoyed it. It's weird
when you've done
a movie. And so you have to kind of fight your own demons in terms of, you know, fight your worry or fight whatever, you know, you think, oh, well, they did that different and they did that different. So you're obviously biased but I think he did a great job with that. And I think the acting is really good. And I mean, you know, are you going to ask me which one do I prefer?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. That wouldn't be. That's like picking a favorite child. So no, I wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, something else I hadn't realized. It's very shameful. I had been very aware of Dogma 95 because I would have been in college when that happened, and we all thought it was the coolest thing that we were into Dogma films. How stupid we were at the time! But I hadn't realized your movie Open Hearts was also part of that whole thing, and I'm just wondering, looking back now, like it was seemed like such a great idea in some ways to make these movies. For people who don't know, Dogma was this idea that you would get back to pure storytelling and there would be no special effects and that kind of thing. What's your thoughts on that stuff now that you're making these massive shows and they're wildly successful?
I mean, there's no doubt that Dogma has been incredibly influential, because it did, at a right point in time, kind of kick back European filmmaking into dealing with stories as opposed to trying to aim for copying American cinema. Mm. I enjoy doing a dogma film. Before I did a dogma film, I did like other, my local claim to fame is a comedy, a huge, big romantic comedy, which was enormous. And so I came to dogma as a somewhat pretty, you know, for better or worse, you can say accomplished director. So mm-hmm. Dogma didn't shape me as a director, but sure. I really enjoyed doing a dogma film and I really enjoy what it did. And I have been, you know, I do also enjoy using the cinematic language. I kind of enjoy adding music. I kind of enjoy, scenes are lightning. So I have a huge amount of respect for it. I'm also quite happy to be able to use whatever tools the film director normally can use.
Sure. But you're not going to do the next Avengers movie or anything, are you?
You know, I kind of like doing action. I don't know what I do next, but I'm not really opposed to do anything if I like the story or if I like the, you know.
Yeah.
I'm quite up for any kind of challenge which I feel is meaningful and where I seriously think I can actually pull it off in a great way.
Yeah, great. Well, you pulled off The Undoing, as I said. Me and my wife adored it. So thanks a million for talking to me today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Suzanne Baer, talking to me about The Undoing, which, as I say, is on Sky Atlantic and streaming service Now TV from Monday, the 26th of October. And it is really good. Now, last week on the show, we spent a lot of time talking about Rebecca because I interviewed most of the cast as I banged on about ad nauseum with Kristen Scott Thomas and Lily James and Armie Hammer. But is it actually any good? This is Rebecca on Netflix, available as of this Wednesday of this week. I enjoyed it, but let's really find out. Let's go to our resident critic, Mark Royal, who is, I suppose you could say, the Miss Danvers to my Rebecca. Hello, Mark.
Hi, John. Yeah, you'll have to give me a moment. Very good. Yeah, okay, I'm ready.
I was up all night. Unless you haven't got any crushed ice, I was up all night with a sledgehammer, to quote The Odd Couple. Yes, you're ready. Okay, Rebecca, famous Daphne du Maurier novel. It was made by Hitchcock back in the 40s, I think it was. What of the new version on Netflix released this week?
It's not bad. I mean, of course, it's a waste of time. But I mean, luckily, I currently have some time to waste. The first thing to start with is Ben Wheatley. He's directing, and it's a script by Jane Goldman. And as you said, it was the 1938 Daphne du Maurier classic, which, you know, and it was the 1940 version by Hitchcock. It was his first American movie, and it is obviously a classic. But this remake, I suppose, definitively answers the question, is nothing sacred? The story here, Lily James is the unnamed protagonist. Let's call her the second Mrs. De Winter.
Yes.
She is working as a lady's companion in Monte Carlo, and she meets and falls in love with Armie Hammer's stinking rich widower. They marry, and then Maxim brings his new wife home to Mandalay, the sprawling estate on the Cornish coast. Where things start to go wrong because A, he's still married to a dead woman, and B, so is the icy, formidable housekeeper, Mrs. Danvers.
Yes, well, that's a pretty good summation of it. And then the ghostly presence of Rebecca, be it literal or otherwise, kind of surrounds the house for the rest of the movie.
Indeed. I mean, the weird thing about Rebecca is probably the most interesting character isn't in it. By all accounts, the first Mrs. De Winter was you know, pure evil and manipulative and irresistible, and she sounds infinitely more interesting than half of the characters that we're left with. But I suppose it's difficult not to compare this version with the 1940 Hitchcock one, which I saw recently, so it's even more hard for me to put that out of my head. When you go back to the Hitchcock, one of the things that you realize is that many of the obstacles in the story could easily be overcome if the characters had just communicated normally with each other. But I suppose the execution is so masterful that you're willing to ignore some of the faults in the script. Now, Ben Wheatley's version, it does get a lot wrong, but it gets some things right. And I would almost go as far as to say that some aspects of this remake are an improvement on Hitchcock's version. For
wow.
one, yeah.
Sorry, what do you think he gets wrong?
I will get to that.
It's fair enough. Sorry to ask. I'm just a host. Sorry.
I think he was a weird choice of director. And Rebecca really is nothing like any of his previous works, stuff like Sightseers or Kill List or A Field in England. And I'm struggling to come to terms with what it was exactly that drew him to this project, because the bits that you would think would be his forte aren't. And then, like, for example, the stuff at the beginning in Monte Carlo, it's really, really good, but it is more like it's a sort of more is more approach of Baz Luhrmann, and really the only thing missing in that bit is a big song and dance number with, you know, message in a bottle done in a rag tile.
I like the sound of that.
Well, I mean, go and watch a Baz Luhrmann movie. The thing is, though, that he really seems to lose focus or even interest sometime in between the move from Monte Carlo to Manderley, which is odd because this is really where he should come into his own. But having said that, it does make some improvements. For one thing, I think Lily James and Armie Hammer, they make a much more convincing couple than Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier. I know I'm wrong for that.
But I can hear you.
Yeah, one of the issues I had with Hitchcock's Rebecca is that I could never really quite buy into the notion that there was any kind of physical attraction between, you know, Fontaine and Olivier. Although, having said that, I suppose the Hays Code or the production code was to blame for a lot of that. But to go on, I mean, Armie Hammer, he is woefully miscast. He does make a good fist of getting his vowels around Maxim's upper-class English accent, but he just does not look the part. He's too athletic and he's too all-American to convince as an aristocrat. And he doesn't sell the torment of the character. He just seems to frown a lot. On the upside, I think Lily James is much, much better in probably what is her 475th role this year. I'm convinced that she doesn't live anywhere. She just moves from set to set. She may be
going a bit quieter for a wee while, but anyway, we're not that kind of tabloid show, so let's move on.
Not for me to comment on, no. One of the frustrating things about Joan Fontaine's character is that she was a textbook example of a leading woman with no agency whatsoever. She was like a leaf in the breeze. And James in this is, she does bring some agency to the character. She's not a doormat. Then, of course, we have to talk about Kristin Scott Thomas, who is just in a completely different league altogether.
She's brilliant in it. She's brilliant in it.
She runs rings around the competition whenever she is on screen. Going back again to Hitchcock, Judith Anderson, who portrayed Mrs. Danvers, she was kind of inhuman and slightly otherworldly, but Scott Thomas is a lot less panto villain, and you can really believe why this Danvers has ended up the way she has. And a lot of it is desperation and age and a loss of choice and options that comes with age. But she also brings an awareness to Danvers that I don't think was there in Judith Anderson's character. And there's a resignation to her ruthlessness that makes Scott Thomas seem more threatening in this.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way of putting it. She was threatening and scary. Like, from my point of view, as I told Kristin Scott Thomas last week, and Ben Wheatley, and Armie Hammer, and Lily James, look, it's done, it's gone.
Are you finished?
Yeah, for now. For now. It won't last long, though. But I read this book years ago, and I loved it, and I still love it. And it's what I like about it is, you know, often you're given classics to read, and I don't know, they just, they disappoint you, or in my experience, I mean, not always, but I remember loving Rebecca, and I gave it to my wife not long after we met, and she loved it too. And I watched the Olivier version, and as a book I loved, I thought this was a pretty good, faithful retelling of it. It didn't have too many kind of modern flourishes, which I was kind of dreading nearly. So I was pretty much on board with it from start to finish. I take your point about Armie Hammer, but I also take your point, which you're well made, about Lily James being great in it and Mrs. Danvers, Kristin Scott Thomas, being amazing in it. Yeah. So I think we're kind of on the same page on it.
Yeah, there's one particular change that it is more faithful to Du Maurier's book than the Hitchcock version. Again, that's going back to the Hays Code.
We can't get into that.
No, we can't get into that, no.
Yeah. So what would you say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it a 3. I think it's a really good story and it's mostly well told. But I think hopefully after watching this, it might point viewers to want to seek out the original. It's just a shame that the Hitchcock version isn't actually on Netflix.
Well, I would probably give it 3 as well, maybe 3.5. I'm not sure, but I certainly enjoyed it. And as I was saying to someone the other day, I think Netflix movies might be getting a bit better, you know, based on the evidence of this and a few recent ones. But
let's not count our chickens.
Okay. Well, listen, nice to have you back, Mark. I had to make way for you last week. Well, did I mention Kirsten Scott Thomason? I probably did.
No, I didn't. But it's, you did. Do you want to mention it again?
It's nice to have you back and we shall talk again next week. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Ken Jeong from The Hangover on Going Over the Moon.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. I'm John Fardy. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Now take a listen to this.
Mama used to tell me stories of the moon goddess.
She's on the moon, waiting for her one and only true love.
It's just a silly myth.
It's not a silly myth. It's real. Right, Papa? It's you and me, Bungie. We're gonna prove she's real.
I'm gonna be there soon. In my rocket too.
It's a long flight.
Ew.
Yes, that's a clip from Over the Moon, which landed on Netflix on the 23rd of October this Friday. And it's a delightful little movie. I don't know why I say little. There's nothing little about it. In fact, it's kind of huge. It's an animated movie all about a young girl you heard there called Feifei, who loses her mother and becomes obsessed with this Chinese legend of a lady called Chang'e who lives in the moon and is longing for the return of her lover. And she builds a rocket and attempts to get to the moon. Once she gets to the moon, she encounters all these strange moon creatures and possibly the princess. Well, she does meet the princess. It's very bright. It's very colourful. It has a lot of music in it, very nice music. It's a real good one for the kids over the midterm, I would suggest. I enjoyed it a lot. It made me smile. It has a fantastic voice cast in it, everyone from Sandra Oh to my first guest, Ken Jeong, who you will know is playing Mr. Chow in The Hangover. And of course, he started life as a doctor, a physician, and he's gone on to do all sorts of things. He's done a lot of animation movies. In this, he plays Gobi, who's kind of this moon creature. He was very taken with the movie. So I'm going to bring you my interview with him. I also spoke to Margaret Chow, who's another American comedian who's been doing stand-up for years, and she was on Saturday Night Live. She plays Feifei's Auntie Ling. It's a very Chinese movie in that the family are all very connected in it. Most of the voice casts are American Asian. And she also plays one of the creatures on the moon when Feifei gets there. And we're not even sure what she is, a chicken, something like that. Anyway, here's my chat with Ken Jeong and Margaret Chow. Ken, if I could start with you, I read something and I've no reason to doubt it, but it said that you cried when you read the script. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, when I did one of the voiceover sessions I did, it was just very emotional. And I've never during an animated voiceover session just start crying. it was just kind of like I was getting very emotional. I think when my character says, you know, has an emotional beat with, you know, with Feifei, it's an emotional movie, and it's such a cultural revelation for me, at least in the world of animation. So, you know, it was never happened to me, especially as a comedian.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It could have also been because my lunch wasn't ready, so I might have been crying because of that. So either way, I'd like to say for the purpose of this interview.
No problem. Your secret's safe with mine.
Yeah, anyway. Thank you. Please, no, Ireland. Please don't tell anyone else, Ireland, what I just said.
Margaret, you play two characters, one on Earth and one on the moon, an auntie, and then Gretch is the character. And also from my reading, apparently that was like a Wizard of Oz kind of vibe. Were you aware of that? That's what the filmmakers were going for?
Yes. So I guess it would have been some kind of like a the Cowardly Lion kind of the switch kind of thing. Like, it's very exciting though. And I love being like a chicken and an auntie. To me, it's really perfect. And yeah, it's like biker babe, auntie, motorcycle riding chicken. I think it's a chicken, rooster chicken, something like that. It's really awesome.
I was hoping you could tell me, actually.
I'm not sure, but I really felt, to me, it's more chicken, but I think I don't know. It's really, but it's a chicken in space, maybe. Yes, yes. I'm going
chicken
with
it. Chicken in space.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Wonderful.
I love it.
And did you feel the same kind of cultural, like Ken mentioned that he'd never read anything like this before, and it's all Asian and it's just so different to everything else. Did you get that same sense?
Yes, I actually was there I was in Shanghai with Pearl Animation Studios, who is the studio that made it in 2018. So I actually saw the initial drawings and heard some of the songs in the very, very early stages. And so I was really immersed in the very beginning stages of the film. And so I was really in the kind of emotional root of it. And it was very culturally significant and really beautiful. And I was really emotional and moved by it too. So I had the great sense of this being kind of a Lion King for us too. It was great.
Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it. Ken, I hate to do this, but just as you're speaking to Ireland, no matter what you do for the rest of your life, our country will just always see you as that wonderful role in The Hangover. And I'm just wondering, did that change your life? I know you're probably tired of talking about it, but just quickly, was that a game changer? Is that kind of the reason why you're sitting here talking to me 3,000 miles away?
Absolutely. If it wasn't for The Hangover, I wouldn't have a career. So to me, that it just everything I've enjoyed in the last 11 years is because of that movie. And just to be able to be in a position to do something like Over the Moon and some, you know, this is something I really want to do more for my kids and my daughters, even more than me. So than for me. But when you're having an eye for the future, you know, that's where you want to be in your career. And so I think Over the Moon really exemplifies that. But absolutely, if it wasn't for The Hangover, I wouldn't be here talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And Margaret, just finally then, you started life, and I mean, you still are a stand-up. Is it, you know, you never hang up the boots, as Robin Williams said, but is it fun for you to do movies and things like this, but then also to get back to standing on that stage and hearing what the world is really like?
I love it and I miss it. It's really hard. Ken and I did stand-up comedy 25 years ago, and we miss it a lot. So we can't wait to get back to doing it. So hopefully we'll be able to be back soon. It's been sad. It's been hard for comedians right now because we really miss it. It's very much an addiction and we're jonesing for sure.
Okay, well, you're looking well on it. You must have been teenagers when you did stand up. If it was 25 years ago. That's trademark Irish flattery for you. You know?
I have an in utero recollection of being on stage. It was My neonatologist said, you know, time to just get some rest. I was like, okay.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Yes, Ken John from The Hangover, which I couldn't help asking him about, and Margaret Chow there talking to him about Over the Moon. Now, it's directed by legendary animator Glenn Keane, who did the animation on classics like The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. I mean, this guy has gone back a long time and he's done a great job on this. He really has. Have a listen to Glenn Keane. Hi Glenn, John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Ireland. How are you?
Very good, John. Nice to meet you.
You too. Listen, I watched this with my three children and the middle one is a girl who's 5 and I was keen for her to watch it because there's a nice message about, you know, female empowerment, for want of a better phrase. And yet, you know, I was a bit the moment where, not to give a spoiler, but mother leaves the earth. Is that your, you know, is that important in the great kids movies and kids stories that there's something about adult world is conveyed in them?
Well, In the characters that I've animated, I know that they may be animated, but for a child, they are real. you live in their skin. The only way to animate them is to live in their skin and to become little Feifei, a little 5-year-old Feifei to 9-year-old Feifei to 12-year-old Feifei. And I'm very conscious of the fact that that character becomes a vehicle for this story. And this story really goes on quite a deep journey of emotions. And you take it very seriously that when what you are doing is taking the children and you're going to let them experience loss through Feifei, and so that they will understand that sadness and pain are part of life, but on the other side, there's this wonderful joy and fulfillment that they will have. This was very important for all of us to tell a story with that kind of those mature themes and still deliver it in the most joyful, fun, beautiful way.
Yeah, well, you certainly did that. And sticking with the joy of it, I read that Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd was an inspiration partially in how parts of the moon looked. Is that accurate or?
Yeah. Well, you know, in Wizard of Oz, when you go to Oz, you go from a black and white film to Technicolor. And that's just like, what a great idea, but no, that they've done it. So how are we going to do that where we go to Lunaria on the dark side of the moon? And I gave to our production designer the album cover from Pink Floyd of the white light into the prism exploding into colors. And that became the guide for us. The earth was about reflected light. In Lunaria, it was source light. It was light from this goddess. Everything is born from the goddess's tears. When I saw Feifei in Lunaria for the first time, as we were working on this, these glowing, floating buildings, unlike anything that you've ever imagined, my reaction was, I just laughed and cried. I mean, as a director, I was so thankful for what Celine gave me to discover this character, Chang'e, there in the Chinese culture, working with Pei Lin Chow and Jenny Rim, who really have this great respect for the Asian culture, to have that kind of guide, these guides through making this film was really incredibly important for me.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you mentioned Asian culture, and about halfway through the movie, because I knew very little about it. It's how I like to sit down and watch a film, you know, and I knew very little about it. And halfway through, I went, oh yeah, it's all Asian. And my kids, who I mentioned, at no stage or since have even mentioned that, which I suppose is success in a way. Of course, you're making an all Asian movie, but the fact that kids come away from it blindingly unaware that it has anything to do with Asia is probably success, I guess. Or is it? Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely wonderful. Because when we went to China, sat down and had dinner with Chinese families, we were welcomed into their homes. And the family, the roots of the family are so deep and important. The love of parents to their children, grandparents, the generations so clearly communicated to us that love. I love the idea that, you know, Picasso says, I'm always doing that which I don't know how to do in order that I may learn how to do it. I didn't know anything about the Chinese culture except what I've read about. But what I came away with was their love of family, the honesty that a family has in a circle, literally a circle around a table. I learned about their love of food. Everybody had their favorite noodle from every part of China. And this incredible technology beyond anything we have in America. I rode on a magnetic levitation train that goes 431 kilometers an hour, and doesn't touch anything, it floats. I mean, this was insane, but we used all of that in this movie.
Yeah, you use it very well. Lovely to talk to you. The movie's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A lot of fun talking with you too.
Glenn Keane there talking to me about directing Over the Moon, which is now streaming on Netflix. And then finally, I got to talk to the young girl, young newcomer actress who plays Fei-Fei, Cathy Ang. She kind of got the role rather serendipitously. And then the lady who plays the moon goddess, Chang'e, is an actress called Philippa Sue, who came to fame in America for being in Hamilton. And she's a wonderful singer in this as well. Have a listen to this. Cathy, can I start with you? I read that yours was almost accidental, the fact that you're the lead voice in this, that you went in to do kind of a demo, a tempo demo to help them with the song, and then they went, we want her, and you got the part. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the take that you hear in the movie of me singing Rocket to the Moon was actually when I was like auditioning for the role. It's a crazy situation. I knew some of the creative team beforehand, but of course, like with a movie like this, with all of these stars and such a powerhouse on the creative team, I really didn't expect to get the role. I mean, you know, I thought it was going to go to someone who has more credits under the name, but they took a chance on me, and you know, these people just believed in the Fei-Fei that I brought to the table. So it's a dream come true. And I'm very thankful that they picked me. I don't know. I still don't really know why, but I'm so grateful for it.
Come. Philippa, you play, I don't want to pronounce your name because Irish people butcher Asian names, but let's call her the Moon Princess. Had you been aware of her? Had you heard about this legend or myth of this lonely woman in the moon who's longing for her lover?
Yes, I had. I read a children's book called The Moon Lady. Okay. And it was also through the eyes of a little girl that was sort of referencing the myth. So when I first read about this script and I heard about this story, I was like, oh, I know that. I know who that is. And, you know, I was very surprised to learn that we're not only seeing a little bit of what the myth is, but we're seeing what happens after she gets to the moon. Because everything that we know is when she gets to the moon. But this is sort of picking up after that. So, you know, of course, through animation, your imagination can run wild. And I really feel like the creative team took it there, and getting to experience this story through the eyes of Kathy's character, Fei-Fei, is one of the most magical journeys that I think anyone can go on.
Yeah. And is it hard to, you know, I guess everyone's asked it when they do a cartoon, but Philippa, is it hard to voice a character that's already there? Like, you see her face and you're putting a voice on it. It must be a strange thing to do or to get into.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was sort of like a very layered process. So, you know, they showed me some renderings of what they thought Chang'e looked like. And then from there, I sort of developed this character. And then as I was, you know, working in the studio, they were filming us. They were filming Kathy and I and all of the actors, our facial expressions. So as the animation became more filled out, we got to see these characters. And honestly, like, I looked at her and I was like, I kind of see myself in it. And you know, thank God for my crazy facial expressions. They've served me well for this project, because I see some of them, these nuances in the film. And even more than that, you know, they layered on that Chang'e's, her clothing is designed by Pei, the actual fashion designer. So when you add these, like that layer on top of everything, it just sort of made the character, you know, we were building it kind of simultaneously.
As you went along.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Cathy, you're talking about credits under your name and maybe not having enough. What are you going to do next? Have you any plans after this?
Because
I'm sure the credits
know.
Will fall in.
I hope so. I sure hope so. I mean, again, it's kind of a weird time for people in the arts industry, for sure. But I hope that I get more opportunities, at least, to try and tell stories, especially about, you know, Asian heritage and about these women who, first of all, love science. I love science and space exploration. And are just, you know, these really bright, maybe sometimes stubborn, silly characters like that. I feel like I relate to that a lot. And so I hope I get more opportunities to tell stories like this.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. Well, lovely to talk to both of you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yes, Cathy Ang, who plays Fei Fei, and Philippa Sue, who plays the moon goddess in Over the Moon, now streaming on Netflix. And it is a delightful movie, and one you might enjoy this weekend with the kids or over the week if you are on midterm break. Well, I think every school is on midterm break if you're in primary and secondary. I may be wrong there. I've just been so glad they stayed open. Up next, philosopher Richard Carney on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. Now, regular listeners will know a couple of weeks ago, I was chatting to the writer of Men in Black and Bill and Ted, Ed Solomon, and I told him about a philosophy professor I had who had a theory about alien movies in the 90s. That philosopher in question was Richard Carney, probably Ireland's best known philosopher, and he's a lot more besides. He's written books of poetry, novels, all sorts of things. His philosophy books are far too numerous to mention. However, his latest one is what's called The Carney Reader and has the intriguing title Imagination Now. More of that in a little while, because live we go now to Boston, where he's the Charles C. Ealing Professor of Philosophy in Boston College, and he's on the line to tell me about his favourite movie. Hello, Richard.
Hello, John.
That was a long intro, wasn't it? Clearly, I'm thinking back to our college days when I need to show you respect and stuff.
Well, there you go. That's when I did all the talking and you did the listening. Now it's the other way around. Anyway.
Your favourite movie is a wonderful choice. It's probably, you know, an art house movie, some people might suggest. I don't know how many people have seen it, but would you tell us what your favourite movie is?
Yeah, it's Paris, Texas. Came out in 1984. Wim Wenders, a German director, filmed in America, in fact, in Texas. Mm-hmm. And very much sort of a parody, a takeoff of the American road movie and the American dream. In fact, very relevant in some respects, even more relevant today in Trump's America. But a very interesting and fascinating sort of examination of the role of image and word within a movie. So I was very captivated by it and by the performances. Harry Dean Stanton plays the main character, Travis, who's in search of his lost wife and lost son. And then his lost wife is played by Nastassja Kinski. So very compelling presences and a very compelling movie. The only thing is, and I have to warn your listeners, it is 2.5 hours long. I'd forgotten that when I watched it in 1985. And it declared in an Dublin interview at the time, I don't know who was the editor in those days, maybe Colm Tobin or Fintan O'Toole. In any case, I was asked my favourite movie, and back then it was also Paris, Texas. So nothing has changed.
Wow, but, and that was 1985.
That was 1985.
Have you watched it since 1985, though? I'm assuming you have.
I did. I watched it again last night.
Oh, wonderful.
For my conversation with you.
Well, and I appreciate it.
I had written about it in one of my books, but, you know, so I checked what I'd said about it at the time. That's going back, you know, 1987, Wake of Imagination. In any case, it's a film that intrigues me. But, and again, I have to warn your listeners, in times of COVID, you know, dark times when you're looking for a movie to distract and entertain, this is probably not it. It's 2.5 hours long. And I don't know what it was about the 80s where we kind of took that kind of stuff coming from German art film and French art film. But so it's kind of heavy going. Even when I was reviewing it last night, I stopped every so often. I'm so used to, you know, the internet culture where everything is quick and fast. But it's really worth it if you want to take it in stages. It's a beautifully contemplative movie and actually very relevant to our times, given the critique of the American imagination at play.
And it's like, I don't want to say it's plotless, because Harry Dean Stanton's character kind of shows up emerging from a weird kind of state from the desert and then goes in search for his wife and child of sorts. But it not a huge amount happens, and I'm not trying to put people off, but it's, as you say, it's a contemplative piece. It's not the Avengers.
It's not the Avengers. It's not action-packed. But when you actually watch it, it is the cinematography is so extraordinary. You find yourself just drawn into it. Like the first 20 minutes is this guy walking out of the desert along American freeways, you know, 16-lane freeways, and dropping off and collapsing, and thereby starts a story, because the guy in the store in the middle of nowhere in Texas discovers his photograph and phones the number, and it turns out to be Travis's brother, who then comes and picks him up. And the story goes on from there. But you got that sort of 20 minutes at the beginning, and then at the end there's 20 minutes where he and Jane, I know this is a spoiler, but it doesn't matter because it's not a plot movie, talk to each other, you know, and maybe we'll get more time to talk about this particular exchange, in a peep show booth where he finally discovers her. He finds his son, first of all, Hunter, who's been adopted by his brother and sister-in-law in Los Angeles. So he goes back and he kind of gets to know his son again after 4 years. And that's very amusing, actually, as father and son sort of test each other out and get to know each other. Mm. And then he takes the son off to look for the lost mother, played by Nastassja Kinski, and discovers her eventually in the basement of a peep show joint in downtown Houston, Texas, and goes in and talks to her. Now, it's a one-way mirror, so he can see her and talk to her, but she can't see him. And there's this extraordinary exchange. Now, it goes on for 20 minutes, but the time flies, where he actually turns away from the one-way mirror, so he doesn't see her as he talks to her. And he tells his story about him and her and how they met and how they lived together and how they had a son. And then this awful tragedy that happens, which I won't give away. Mm. And then she turns away from the screen, puts her back to the screen, and she tells her story. And they discover, actually, that they've totally loved each other ever since this terrible trauma. But it's not a sort of a nice American happy ending, Hollywood happy ending. On the contrary, he then disappears back into the desert, and she is reconciled in a most extraordinarily moving scene with her son, Hunter. So I've given away the entire plot, but it's not a plot movie. It's a kind of an archetypal movie of, you know, the lost mother and the road movie in search of the lost ideal figure. Yeah. And then the kind of renunciation of that, in order to allow space for the mother and son to be reconciled.
Well, you describe it very intriguingly, and I think despite its kind of lack of plot, you might drive people to it, and it sounds like a well worth a watch, one I might revisit. As I say, I think it's been 15 years. I've let you cheat slightly in that I always insist people just choose one movie, because people say, can I choose three and all that kind of stuff. That said, we go back a while. So you did want to mention the movie Her as well, because that's of particular fascination to you, right? The one with Scarlett Johansson and Joaquin Phoenix from a few years ago.
Yeah, well, actually, there's kind of a link between the two in this respect, that they're both about the power of the image. Now, in Paris, Texas, photographs are good. They bring back memory. The photo Matt's picture in his pocket of him and his wife and his child, that brings back his memory, because he's lost his memory. He's lost his voice at the beginning of the movie. And then his brother shows a home movie of Travis and Jane and Hunter in the good old days when they were a happy young couple before this trauma took place. Mm. And he has a picture, and this is quite important, I'm getting to her, of Paris, Texas, which is a little strip of wasteland in Texas. It's not Paris, France, it's Paris, Texas, where his parents had conceived him, the main character, Travis, and then given him a present of the plot of land. So he's sort of in search of this lost memory. The whole thing is about searching for lost memory that trauma has wiped out. So there's a reflection on good images that testify to memories that have been lost and guide us, and then kind of contemporary images that bedazzle us and alienate us and enslave us. And that's represented by the billboard sort of corporate culture throughout the movie, where there is no America, there is no American memory. There is only American sensation in the present moment. And Vendor, in an interview at the time, said, my movie is about America that has colonized our unconscious and remade the world in its own image. So it's a very profound critique of a certain American corporate consumerist capitalist way of life. And yet at the same time, arguing for a basic humanity of love between these characters who are lost, but find each other in the end. Now, what's the link with her? Spike Jones is also a reflection on the image, the Spike Jones movie, rather, where Joaquin Phoenix, the character, falls in love with his digital persona called Her in an operating system. And she's played by Scarlett Johansson. In fact, it's only a voice. He falls in love with the voice. And it's a very interesting reflection on sort of contemporary digital image culture and the whole nature of addiction, where he falls so in love with the disembodied voice persona that when at one point in the movie, and again, I won't give it away for anyone who hasn't seen it, although it's a much more recent movie, he encounters and has a brief relationship with a surrogate sort of physical representative of OS, of Her. But he can't relate to the real person because he's lost touch actually with real relationship. So mesmerized has he become by the digital image.
And this dovetails nicely with your forthcoming book, which I gather is all about touch in the digital age.
It is. It's simply called Touch, Recovering Our Most Vital Sense. And it is a reflection, a critical reflection on our contemporary digital culture, where we have become, as the philosophers say, optocentric, where the eye rules. And touch, in many respects, has been neglected, if not forgotten. Now, in the COVID culture, which we all are obliged to live in at the moment, touch is forbidden in so many respects. And I think, and this is one of my points, in a culture where touch, where we're losing touch with ourselves and with others, and losing touch with the sense of touch, we actually are becoming more aware of how important it was. Like when you're not allowed to hug people anymore, shake hands, you become aware of just how important a part of life that was. And in hospitals, as we know, caretakers say that people who are dying of the virus, the thing that's most important for them is that they be touched by the caretaker. They can't be touched by their family or friends who aren't admitted to the hospital. But the need for touch. So it's in a way when something is lost, that you appreciate it even more. And the book argues for sort of a collaboration, a creative collaboration between the digital image and the tactile experience. It's not sort of saying all technology is bad, but it is saying we need to recover our tactile sense, which from the beginning of time in philosophy, at any rate, Aristotle recognized as the most important of the senses. But Plato said that, no, it was sight and ideas that were the most important. So Plato actually won that argument. And in our contemporary digital image, the eye reign imagination, the eye reigns supreme. So this is just a call for, a plea for a recovery of touch to supplement and complement sight.
Fascinating, really fascinating stuff. We don't have a huge amount of time left, but I want to ask you finally, I mentioned in the introduction that you're latest book, The Carney Reader, has the title Imagination Now. And I said also you've written on all sorts of things, but, and this is fitting that you're on a film show, is imagination the, and it's a very large question, but is it the prevailing preoccupation of your creative life and maybe your life in general?
It is. Well, certainly of my
creative life.
Intellectual life, and probably also maybe my personal life. I think, you know, imagination is always on, even when we dream, even when we go to sleep, imagination is on. And there are all kinds of imagination, good imagination where we become, you know, slaves and addicts and consumers, and good imagination where we really have a deep sense of things. Even the way we look at a tree is so imbued with imagination and our relationships with other persons. So, yes, I would say from the beginning, my first publications were imagination, The Wake of Imagination in the 80s, Poetics of Imagining, Postmodern Imagination. So, yeah, and I'm still coming back to it with this reader, which sort of collects the works over the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Well, I guess I should say something glib like dream on, Richard, or something like that. But I wouldn't go there. That's too obvious. His favorite movie is Paris, Texas. Richard Carney, a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure to talk to you too, John. Thank you very much.
I can't even hardly remember what happened. It's like a gap.
Have you seen Jane or talked to her?
thought you were dead, boy.
How long have I been gone, do you know?
4 years.
Is 4 years a long time?
It is for a little boy.
What's out there?
I gotta go away now.
Why?
Because I'm gonna find her.
A clip there from Paris, Texas. And my thanks to Richard Carney, Philosopher King. That's a philosophy joke. Forget it. I'll move on. That is it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. Just to remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcast. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Have a good week. As you know, I'm a massive Bruce Springsteen fan. There's a new album in town, so I think it's only appropriate I play some Bruce music from the movies to finish out. Edward Burns starred in and directed a movie called No Looking Back, and he populated it with a lot of great Bruce Springsteen songs, chief among them this one. Enjoy your week, and I will talk to you next week.
Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? I got a bad desire. Oh, I'm on fire. Tell me now, baby, is he good to you? And can he do to you the things that I do? Oh, no. I can take you high. Like someone took a knife, baby, edgy and dull, and cut a 6-inch valley through the middle of my skull. At night I wake up with the sheets soaking wet and a freight train running through the middle of my head. Only you.